Welcome to Executives After Hours, real conversations with real leaders. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. I want to make you a promise that over the next 60 minutes, you will learn at a minimum two things. One, every leader and executive makes mistakes on the way to the top. And two, and more importantly, everyone has a unique story to tell. And that's what we do here on Executive After Hours. We sit down with leaders across a variety of industries, and we talk to them about their unique story. So welcome to the community, and stay tuned for today's episode on your Executives After Hours. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Executives After Hours. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. Today on the episode, had the pleasure of interviewing Mr. Mitch Joel. Mitch is the book author of Six Pixels of Separation, also same podcast name, and Control-Alt-Delete, his newer book. Both fantastic reads about the role of technology in our life. It's what he specializes in, it's what he talks about. He's also a founding member of a company in the Mirum Group, which they had a former name but got purchased by John Walter Thompson. And now there's a consortium of digital marketing companies around the globe, and his is one of them. And he's just a great guy. In fact, you know, he's the guy, if you ever saw the movie Almost Famous, he basically was that kid in Canada at an early age interviewing. So he's got a rich history, which you kind of can tell when you talk to someone who does a ton of interviewing and has been interviewed. They tend to be longer-winded, a lot of detail. Not a good or bad thing, just different than someone who doesn't do a lot of interviews. So anyhow, I also want to say thank you to my content partners, C-Suite Radio, Engage Me, and Transformation Radio. And as I've been saying, listen, if you're interested in helping me out with my book, please go to my website, drjameskelly.com, click on the book section, fill out the little form, and you can help edit several of the chapters if you like. All right. So listen, everyone, have a great week. Go to iTunes, leave a review. Got a cracker of a month lined up, so stay tuned. Spread the word. See you!
Our own roads. Too bad. I don't know. It's hard to know.
So, like, what was one of the, you know, as you're interviewing these different bands, is there a story that kind of stands out?
Oh, I mean, that's a hard, that's like saying, was there an hour in your workday in like a period of 10 years that stood out? It's hard for people to understand what that job is. That job is literally doing 8 to 10 interviews a day.
Yeah.
So when you say that, I'm like, oh, like ask me another question, because that one is like, I mean, we're talking about thousands of conversations.
So let me ask you a different question then. So to your point, is there an event that occurred while you're doing this where you thought, whoa, this is a book. Like this event is a book.
Oh yeah. I mean, yeah, so many. I can't share them with you though. Yeah. I mean, look, there, you know, the dynamic of it was really strange because I was so young. And then as I got older, I was known. So you had people who were like heads of record companies, major managers, major producers, all that stuff that I had almost grown up with, but because I was young, I still had. So there's a lot of times like, should we sign this artist? What do you think of this artist getting advanced copies of an album? Should we distribute it in Canada or not? Just conversations like that, that led me to meet artists long before they were anybody, mm-hmm. which led to really strong relationships to this day. So it is one of those things where I have many, many crazy stories. And because of that, I'm always hesitant to talk about them, not because I'm saving it for a book, but I don't know who remembers what anymore. You know what I mean? Like I'm worried I would say a story and the person would be like, I've cleaned up since, or like I would offend somebody.
Yeah,
and I wouldn't want to do that. But yeah, I mean, look, you're the only sober one in a very bizarre world of people who have way too much of things way too fast.
So are you someone who is – so I would imagine in that environment and growing up from 17 to – and we'll talk about when you left. But there's a sense of power almost over this, right, over time of like self-worth. Like I'm in this space that people die to be in. Did you feel that as you were kind of going through this process?
No, I'm a weird, I still have this imposter syndrome slash, I've done nothing type of thing, not in a really negative and depressing way, but I just feel like there's so much more to go. So people would say to me in hindsight, man, you were like one of the biggest, you know, rock music writers in metal or Canada or punk or whatever. And in my brain, I was like, I've at that time felt like nothing. Do you know, not in a negative way, but just like there's just so much more to do. And candidly, I still have a lot of that baggage is with me to this day, where I feel like, oh, like there's still so much more to do. So I don't know. It's funny. Like I'm really attracted to the Jeff Bezos concept of day one. And I feel like I use it differently. I feel like I use it like as an excuse. Like, oh, it's only day one, so there's a lot more time to do a lot of things. I'm like, I don't have to worry, because then, you know, if I didn't achieve anything, it's still day one. Versus Jeff Bezos, who probably looks at like day one means we always, you know, we're in a very different dynamic. So I always felt like it was day one, just probably differently than Jeff Bezos explains it.
So is that humility or is that self-deprecation?
It's humility, it's self-deprecation, and it's anxiety. You know, it's just the sort of general, that feeling. I mean, I look around at people who have accomplished a lot and who sort of emote it very well. And I wonder if they really believe that, or if they go home at night and think to themselves like, oh, I can't believe I pulled that off another day. I don't know, and I don't judge it. I look at it and I marvel like, wow, that's a real, you know, when someone has a command of a stage or an audience, I'm always like, do they go home after and think like, what am I doing there? And again, like we're recording this, I don't know when you're publishing it, but we're recording in a moment where Chris Cornell from Soundgarden Audios just passed away. And it was, you know, it's one of those things that shakes me to my core, not just because I've interviewed him many times over the years and I didn't get to know him, but spent time with him and the band and blah, blah, blah. But it shook me to my core, because how do you get off stage, you know, 5, 10, 20,000 people and feel that alone? Mm-hmm. Now, I know it's a mental illness and I understand the depths of that for sure, more than the average bear might. But it still sort of really strikes me at my core, because clearly he was someone who, especially being a male, right? There's a certain weakness that we attach to things like, you know, whether it's mental illness or depression or even things as grave as suicide. And part of it has to do with that. Well, it looks like I'm in command here, right? And that always, it scares me, because I see both sides of it.
So what did you mean by, you know, better than most do in terms of...
Oh, I've just been around a lot of scenarios where people have had extreme, you know, I've sadly known a lot of people who've committed suicide. You know, sadly been around people who have real challenges with mental illness. Definitely understand it in terms of anxiety and stress personally. And again, if you've ever had any form of a panic attack, anxiety, any form of those things, you realize that like it's, you know, when you start understanding it, at least to me, it's the brain is an organ. Mm-hmm. And so we'll be like, oh, your kidneys are having a struggle. That's really too bad. But when you say like your brain is having a struggle, it's like, oh, come on, suck it up, you know, get up, you know,
why do you think there's this disconnect? Right.
It's society. Again, you know, there's Maslow's hierarchy of needs in there. There is our sort of hunter gatherer mindset. There's a lot of stuff in that, you know, Seth Godin talks a lot about this sort of brain, you know, the old brain, the new brain, the lizard brain. That lizard brain is really powerful. I mean, why is it that you haven't produced more, you know, why haven't you done more with your life, James? Right. It's what's holding us back here. Why haven't I written more? It's we have a lizard brain. You know, we have self-consciousness. We have these things that are voices that are telling us stories. And Tony Robbins talks about this in depth, right?
Well, I was kind of going back to that imposter thing, because I know for me, that's something I struggle with, right? So I have a PhD, and if anyone knew me from college or high school, or my third grade teacher that said to my parents that I'm not sure he's okay.
We're still not sure, James, but keep going.
The verdict is still out. You know, but I often am like, do I belong? Right? It's a question of belonging for me. And
sure. Well, we all want to belong. We don't want to be alone.
Yeah, what I mean by belong those is, so yes. So for me, when I say imposter, I mean like, I have a PhD. Do people actually think I'm smart?
Yeah. And for me, it's like, at what point does somebody walk into my office and go, okay, you fooled everybody. It's time to go. you know, like a sense ago. And it, you know, that's normal. I mean, look, you know, we live in a very connected world because of technology. We see a lot more than we see. There's a reason FOMO is a thing, right? Fear of missing out. and it's really easy to look at that and go, you know, clearly this person here to my right knows a lot more than I do. And then there's other moments where I'll jokingly say to friends who've been super successful, like, it's amazing how successful you've become considering the amount of mediocre people you're surrounded by, you know, which is also true. There's a lot of people who are just, you know, really, and with the best of intentions, just trying to make it to the weekend, or just trying to make it to the next mortgage payment, or just trying to get to, like, pay out their debt, or just trying to figure out if their budget will allow them to take a winter vacation or a summer break. And, you know, I emote and feel deeply for that, because they're not even thinking about the stuff that, like, is on my brain. Mm-hmm. And, you know, do I have as much value as the person next to me? Why were they chosen over me? I mean, this is, you know, when you ask, where does it come from? It comes from one place, the human condition. This is who we are.
Yeah, but I have to wonder if there's, you know, for me, everything kind of goes back to the environment you were raised in. So, you know, it's a nature nurture thing, obviously. But for, in my head, you know, taking my journey as obviously only mine, I can see my pitfalls and where they come from my childhood. Like, I can see, like,
yeah, I know. Yeah, you know, I know what you're saying. The thing with that, though, is, like, this is the sort of running joke. I have a friend of mine who's a really well-known cognitive behavioral therapist, and he always says to me, here's what's going to happen. You're going to spend years and years trying to sort of crack open this nut and figure it out. And when you do, you're going to finally realize it's something that happened from your rearing, your parents, your childhood, whatever it might be, physical, nature, nurture, it doesn't. And then what are you going to do with that?
Yeah.
You know, it's that story narrative. At what point is the story too strong for you to change? Or at what point is the story so sort of realizing that it's a story and that it's just that, and you can change that you can overcome it? I mean, there's a reason why, you know, mindfulness and meditation, I think, is taking on the uplift that it's taking on, as people really are desperately trying to spend some time inside themselves, working through the things that you probably ultimately can't resolve, when the answer is probably simply that. There's nature, nurture, rearing parents, something that happened in the biology. Now what?
Right? Well, and the reality is that you just have to accept what's happened, right? And you make the choice of what you do with it. Right.
Yeah, so, and it's hard, and it's really hard. Like, I don't belittle it, and I'm not saying totally. In a way, like, again, that sort of like walk it off. Because like even now, you know, I travel a lot for what I do, and traveling when I was little was a really stressful thing. My parents didn't do it a lot. We didn't have that much money. You know, it was a lot of people to get from one place to another. I didn't fly on a plane until I was older. And it's not like it was told that it was scary, but having never been on one, it's scary when you really think about what it is, and then old enough to understand. And to this day, right before a trip, I get that sort of the butterflies going. And I was like, this is crazy. I've been 100K plus for over a decade. And yet, and so there are some stories that I think that it's great that I'm able to acknowledge it and go, wow, that's a narrative from when I was really, really young. So, but fighting it physically, that's not always, you know, the easiest thing to do.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I just want to jump a little bit back. So why did you decide to leave writing and entertainment?
I don't think I did. I think there was just an evolution. You know, the truth is that I was writing, and I was very engaged in the publishing space. And then I started publishing my own magazines in that space, and I became very interested in the mechanics of the media and advertising and marketing of it. I then, you know, moved into more publishing related stuff and public relations, and then more marketing based stuff. And then there was always the intersection of somewhat technology or the internet in that. And so whether it was, you know, helping launch one of the first search engines before Google was there, working in content, mobile content, literally almost 20 years ago, which is ridiculous to say. I think you can really, you know, again, I talk about that a lot in Control Alt Delete, about it being squiggly. You can sort of, like, you're right, there are people who are musicians who will see me and be like, how did you do that? Like, how did you go from the music industry to, like, being this guy? And I'm like, it's the same thing. It wasn't about music or technology. It was about media, brands, consumers. Mm-hmm. I mean, all of those, there are those, you know, as my friend Tamsin Snyder would say, there are those red threads throughout totally to me. So I say that now because, you know, I can say it in reverse, telling you I think it's totally connected. But I can see how if you saw my life in the music industry and then this, you'd be like, what? But no, it's totally connected because it was less about the music. It was more about the media. And even now it's more about the media than it was about it being about, you know, the web or digital or social.
Well, and I think what's kind of interesting to me is, you know, looking at, you know, historically backward through your journey and these evolutions, it's always been about you creating content, right? So it's kind of what you're saying. It's always about content generation for you.
Yeah, I mean, content is just, I often describe it as like an exhaust valve on my neck. You know, it's like at the end of the day, it just goes, oh, like the Tin Man and the Wizard of Oz or something. You know, like it's just been that. I consume a lot, or I try to consume a lot. Sometimes it's very, very shallow. Sometimes it's very, very deep. But I always feel like I need a way to get it out. So, you know, now I get it out like this in a conversation with you. I'll get it out by recording a conversation that I'll have for a podcast later. I might take a note. I might turn it into a book. I might write an article. I might put it on a blog. Like, I use a lot of different channels now to do that. But the other reason I do that is because I remember the limitations of operating in a non-digital world. I remember having a lot of story ideas and having nowhere to put them because I didn't have a platform. So when God or the internet gave me a platform, right? Because who created the internet? God did. And I'm able to, that was a joke. I'm able to,
sorry.
I'm able to now have a thought in text, images, audio, and video and publish it instantly for free to the world. Mm. And that to me is why I'm so insane now about it, is I feel like I don't want to waste that amazing thing that, again, for years I would be writing letters because you didn't even have email. Hey, I've got an interview with artist XYZ. You know, no thanks, we're not interested. I mean, you hear no way more than you hear yes. And getting published was like, you know, you'd run around the house doing high fives and call everybody you know, because it was just such an amazing thing to get past. Again, as Seth Godin will call them, the gatekeepers. And having those gatekeepers, you know, still present but also be gone in terms of our ability to publish, I don't just, and that's also why I think I'm not great at things like Twitter and Snapchat. I don't want to devalue the power of the publish button.
Well, and it's so easy nowadays to publish, right? I mean, there's 1,000 mediums. Yeah, I mean,
so I'd rather have less people sort of know about me and more people respect what I'm putting out, because I respect it. And I'm not just going to hit publish because, you know, we got to get some tweets in that machine to keep those numbers floating. It's not who I am.
So thinking about your life, you obviously are you still married? Married? Yes.
I am.
Okay.
Happily.
Okay. I mean, I've had many interviews where the happily part isn't there. So it's married on the way out, or was married, one of the two. As you're doing these evolutions, where does your wife play in this role? Like, was she there when you were a writer? Did she come when you started Twist before it was purchased? Like, where was she in the process?
All the way through. I mean, back long before that.
Was a high school sweetheart?
No. It was definitely in the workforce. I was actually editing a community newspaper that was focusing on young people and what they were doing in work, whether it was entrepreneurial or not. And in this community building, she was working in like the job placement department, and we met there. So she was there before, you know, I always said she was there when I was in debt.
So after you get married and you start having your children and you start procreating, you have... two boys, three boys.
I have three kids.
Three kids, boy, girls, mix. Okay. How does that change your perspective? Like, do you use your kids as a beacon of what's happening in technology now?
No, not at all. No, I think it changes everything. I mean, I started having kids when I was a bit later. I wasn't as young as some of my peers were.
How old were you with your first child?
You're making me do math now, right? In my 30s, late 30s.
Late 30s. So you have young kids.
Late 30s. Yeah, still young kids, yeah.
So then you and your wife had a bunch of years together just hanging out.
Yeah, which is part of the thing. I think that made us realize once we started having kids how useless that part of our life was. You're like, what were we doing? Like going out for dinner and movies and hanging out. It just felt – so I think that was the big realization, is that I wasn't sure if I wanted kids. Hmm. And then having them made me realize that I don't really know much about life.
Yeah. You didn't know why you waited.
Yeah, yeah. And again, I think it's good and bad. You know, the waiting is good and bad. It's good because I was able to somewhat establish myself and have the ability and, you know, give myself time to focus on the business and having, you know, whatever, however I define success and I consider it successful. I think it's bad because, you know, you sort of get up off the floor with young kids and you're like, oh boy, am I old for this? it's a little bit of both. From a tech standpoint, though, you know, again, mine are young. Yeah. And so the best way I explain it to my peers is I'm trying to maintain their innocence for as long as I can.
That's tough.
So they don't have devices or screens. We don't even have family devices or screens. We do, but to them, they're known as their dads. Mm-hmm. And it's to be borrowed from me to be used. But in school, clearly, you know, they're in really modern schools that have them all over the place and they have friends that are all over the place. And it's hard, you know, it's really hard to sort of look at, especially my oldest's friends and see how adept they are. Yeah. And be able to acknowledge that, look, if you look at all the adults, all we're doing is on our screens all day. And you have to balance that with like the work that my buddy Adam Alter is doing over at Irresistible and Sherry Turkle's done with Never Util- Alone Together and that sort of stuff where, you know, I know that we're on them all the time. And I know that as adults, we're on them all the time. And I know that kids see us as adults on them all the time. And I don't know what's healthy and what's not. But I can tell you this, that since I go to the TED conference every year, and it just happened in, I think it was February or April, I can't remember, probably about a month ago, actually. And that just the one thing that, you know, again, I was spending time with Adam Alter, who spoke there this year, I said, I'm going to do one thing, which is I'm not going to touch my smartphone while we eat together at any meal. And it's illuminating to watch your own body want to go there and to like literally physically tell yourself, don't put your hand in that pocket. Don't pull that thing out. Even if you're being asked the question, you need to Google it.
Yeah.
Don't do that.
It's worse when you see someone else do it, right? Like it's that, like I'll see someone reach for it and grab theirs and look. I'm like, oh yeah, I should check. Like,
well, I'll tell you again, and I try, you know, my whole thing now is to not, again, as you get older, you want to be more, I don't want to judge people. Yeah. You know, I was in the store literally yesterday. We were in New York and I was watching this mom, this young mom push her kid through the store while this kid who was maybe not even two staring at the iPhone, you know, cartoons that are going on that thinking, okay, I get it. Like you want to shop and you don't want to be, but like there's a lot to look at in this world.
Yeah.
There's a lot to see. And so again, I'm not trying to judge, but I am just trying to point out that nobody has the answers.
Yeah.
And that all I know is that for all of this, you know, screens are bad. There's a reality of screens are everything. And the longer that I'm not allowing my kid to really embrace and dive deep into it, perhaps I might be unintentionally or intentionally holding them back.
So
that's my concern. I don't know.
How old is your oldest, can I ask?
Not relevant. How's that?
Okay.
I mean, I don't really talk about things like even how many I have, if I'm married, if I'm not. So even this alone is like, we're heading down there.
For you. Sorry.
But it's not that it's uncomfortable. Here's the truth about this world we live in. And again, if people like you asked me about this before we did the interview, and I was pretty candid with you about how I am. I don't want to ruin my kids' lives or digital lives. I do not want I would be mortified right now if you could go back to pre-birth and see pictures of me along the way every single weekend, everything I did with my parents, everything, my brothers, and people post that stuff. And I get it. I love seeing it. I just don't know.
Do you really?
Yeah. I really actually do. I love seeing people who are not my immediate friends, but who I really like and seeing their families. It gives me the greatest joy and warmth in the entire world. That being said, I don't necessarily know that any of us know what we're really doing. And I don't want to be in a place where I've made choices for any of my children that are now everywhere for everybody to see. And it's only augmented, not because I have any form of celebrity, because I really don't feel that about myself. I feel like I do a lot of work and some people really like my work and I'm very appreciative of that. But I don't think that forces me or you to have to care about that part of my life. So that what I tell people is I love being very personable, which I hope I'm being to you, but I don't like to be too personal because, well, it's personal.
No, that's fair. And that's definitely a perspective that you can own. You know, I agree with the photos. Like when I have four kids and my oldest is 9 And so I'm fairly open on my podcast just about my life in general, but that's kind of my stick, right? So
that's that's my great. I'm just really, I don't want to be in a place where.
Oh, I respect that.
Like, and like it's things too. Like there's also things just like, you know, insurance and life and vocation and work. And I don't know that we know how much content we're creating about people who have no say in the legacy we're building for them.
Yeah.
And so I go very much into that place where I'm like, I'd rather not and have them say after, I can't believe you didn't post all my friends have pictures of me from, well, we didn't. And now you can make a choice.
Well, you know, and I think, early on, I said to my wife, I took it from a more of a security perspective, but I kind of said, you know, you're basically creating our kids. You're almost prostituting our kids out with all the photos that you're taking to the world without them having to say if they want people to see them making a poopy face or, you know, throwing up or whatever, like cute thing they're doing or bad thing they're doing. Like, you're not really giving them a choice. And I think what I find is now, especially my older two, even my daughter who's two, the youngest, I mean, as soon as the phone comes out, a smile's on their face, they're trying to perform for the camera. You can see the training, the Pavlov's dog experiment, essentially, when the phone comes out, kid smiles and starts to act. And, you know, this is just one data point in my house, but I can imagine that these are millions of data points of this with kids. It's the instant response when a phone comes out.
So think about it too. And this is sort of the other area. And I have so many of them. Again, we could spend 2 hours talking just about this, which is now you take out your phone and your kids typically feel like they're being recorded, a picture, a video. And my feeling is that people act very differently when there's a photo or video being taken. And this sort of sudden apprehension that kids of the age of your kid and younger have now, I think is telling us something.
It's kind of unhealthy.
So again, what's it saying to them psychologically? And remember, they're not us. They don't have the understanding, the psychological capacities that we have of things like I'm being recorded other than like this shows up somewhere. So again, I've been with my kids and they've said things like, I'll want to just take a picture. And they'll say, I don't want it on Facebook or I don't want this to go on YouTube. And I said, why do you think it would go there? They don't know. They don't understand the disconnect between having media on a device that you're then uploading or streaming live, or they're not us. Mm-hmm. And so their immediate thing was, whatever you're doing, everybody in the world will see. Think about the psychological like ramifications of that on the brain of a 9-year-old, an 8-year-old. It's crazy.
My son's like, can I have a YouTube channel? My friend has it. I'm like, no. It's like, you cannot. Like, you're
and
nine.
Then imagine the opposite, which is they're more shy or they're more this. Imagine the terror of that.
Yeah.
And again, we sort of just take it for granted because we know. But I don't know that we know that well.
Oh, I don't think we have any idea of the long-term ramifications yet. I think that we are 10 or 15 years away from seeing it, because I think maybe the first generation's coming through, 16, 17-year-olds. But smartphones have been around for what? Just 10 years now?
Longer, but about that,
10, 12 years.
I'm going to guess we're going to see increased anxiety, increased depression. Mm-hmm. I think we're going to see an increase in all of that. Yeah. That's my guess.
It's kind of, it's a bit scary. So a couple more questions, and I want to do my fast five, but I want to kind of get to, so what I want to do is I have a fast five segment, like every good podcast nowadays. I've got five random questions. And then I kind of want to talk about how Twist Image formed the purchase and kind of where it's going, right?
Sure.
So, all right. So are you ready to do my fast five? Just say yes.
Sure.
All right. Question one, what was your first job ever?
The one I talk about most is rock music journalist.
Did you have one before that where you made money?
Yeah. You know, working in factories, working in frozen yogurt, delivering newspapers, but my first real job.
So I think delivering a newspaper is a fantastic first job.
No, it was. I probably worked in my dad's pharmacy too. I just, when people say, like, what's your first, like, I always say, like, a real job, you know, not like when you're a kid.
Yeah, but it's funny. So, you know, over 100 interviews, I've asked that question of 90 people. And there's a large percentage of successful CEOs where their first paying job was delivering newspapers.
I'm sure mine was something like, if it wasn't that, it was, you know, maybe babysit, but it was probably that.
Yeah. Well, I just think it was, I think delivering newspapers is a fascinating first job because all the lessons you learn, dependability, reliability, collections,
just even to the whole waking up early thing was brutal.
All right. I feel like that's depressed you already. All right. Question two, who is somebody that you admire?
I've always admired Seth Godin. His writing, for sure. I mean, I think there's something to be said about just his writing and his body of work. That's an impressive thing. But I've had the pleasure of getting to know him a little bit. And I just love the model he had of like building this business, selling that business, using that as a way to work on projects, whether it was a book or a startup. And I always in my brain thought that I was really modeling a lot of my way of thinking after how he did that. I thought that he just sort of lived this charm life to me.
Well, and I subscribe to his daily email blast, and there's always these short, sharp, pointed comments or...
Yeah, he's the greatest.
Yeah. All right. Question three, what animal best represents your management style?
I'm probably a dove, but thankfully I have three other business partners.
And so describe to me how you reflect yourself in a dove.
I just can't. I just want people to be happy and peaceful and nice and, you know, little bird chirpy. And so I'm really not, and Ben, I'm pretty candid about this. I'm not great at being hands on.
Yeah.
And my other three business partners really are. So I'm probably also the one where it's like, oh, someone has to be let go. Well, let me know how that goes. Yeah. Cause I don't want to be anywhere near that. You know, it's not who I am. It's me. All that stuff makes me really uncomfortable.
I can imagine like the anxiety of the bad guy in the room, so to speak. Question four, what traits annoy you the most in your colleagues?
CC and BCC.
What the hell does that mean?
When sending a note to me and CCing six other people or BCCing me or like just have a conversation with somebody. If you need somebody else involved, send them a note too. I just find that whole thing, it's like CC to me feels like, you know, it should be called CYA, you know, cover your ass, which should be called.
I feel like it's passive aggressive.
There's all this stuff in there that I just, the whole mechanics of it, even when it's like, gee, thanks so much. And I'm CCing, I'm always like, just send me a note. Like, I just hate it. I hate when I do it.
Yeah, because you're doing a CYA as well.
Yeah, totally.
All right, question five. What situations bring out the best in Mitch?
For me, when I feel my best, it's when the environment really does match my expectations. So as you said it, I was thinking about when I speak, I go in and I have a rider with the sort of how I like my AV set up and how I want to make these events happen because I get paid to speak. And, when it's done like that and there's sort of a vibe in the room and there's respect for that, I feel like I can really deliver. It's when the little things are sort of like, we didn't do that, or we don't either. We decided to do that, where I'm always like, man, whew, you're just not looking for the best.
Yeah. I love it. All right. Thank you for being on. I appreciate it.
No worries.
So I actually was thinking as you were describing this, because do you see yourself as kind of the I'm going to use a band term, the front man for... I know it's not called Twist Image anymore. It's called Miro.
It's called Miro. Yeah. There were two guys here before I got here. It started in 2000. I joined 2002. We had our fourth business partner join a couple of years after me. And I think the visualization that I tend to tell people is while I'm creating content and trying to get a brand in marketplace and for people to care, they're actually making it happen. So I don't look at it like there's a front man or that. In fact, the best way we talk about it internally is that we manage three brands. We manage this Miriam brand, which again was our original agency. It was called Twist Image. We manage Six Pixels of Separation, which is, you know, the blog and content that we create. And we manage this Mitch Joel brand. And I really do try, when I think about the publicness of what I do, that it is a brand. And I try and always have that same messaging and platform around it.
It seems like you're the type of individual that can really separate the Mitch Joel brand from Mitch Joel. Is there a difference, or are they one and the same?
Yeah, no, I think it's very much the same, but the persona is like 20% more in public. You know, people say, what makes a great public speaker? I'm like, you got to be you, but like 20% more. You know, like it, to me, it's just that it's so it, yeah, it's the same person. I mean, I know for sure when I'm with my, you know, my friends or hanging out on the weekend, I don't necessarily want to be talking about, you know, how television is going to operate in a screenless world. You know what I mean? Like, it's not my, like, oh, let's talk about the stuff I've just been talking and thinking about for 24 hours a day. So I tend to sort of try to just do other things, but inevitably, just by the nature of who I am, everything I hear becomes, it's like a being a comedian, I think, where it's like everything you hear can somehow maybe become a joke at some point.
Well, comedians say that all the time, right? So
yeah, just you're always thinking.
So from Twist Image starting in 2002, 2014, WPP approaches you guys. What was the conversation like? Because you guys had grown quite rapidly in the digital marketing space. So what was that conversation like?
So I don't know if it was quite like that. We started the business in 2000, and then we got to a certain inflection point where we wanted to grow. And growth comes in many ways. You can self-invest, you can bring in financing, you can do a bunch of things. And one of the colleagues that we were speaking to, an external colleague, recommended that we get acquired by somebody. It candidly never really occurred to us. We always operated our business from a financial perspective that we would be likable to companies like that and how they look to acquire, because we thought that was just a good way to operate. And then when that idea came out, it became a conversation around, do we want to still be entrepreneurs or do we want to be entrepreneurial? And do we want to be entrepreneurial as we become more operational now because we'll have, you know, bosses? Mm-hmm. And that journey led us to WPP, and it was a very different type of journey, as it is, I think, for any business that gets acquired. I'm so thankful for the experience. It's been an amazing experience. I know people think, oh, he's just saying that on the podcast, but I'm not. I mean, we really did go in as four partners, eyes wide open. It is, you know, several years since the acquisition, over three, and we're still together and still very much operating and entrepreneurial and trying to grow the business. The biggest change is that, you know, along with us, there were many other agencies that had been acquired by WPP through the J. Walter Thompson Corporation, like us, and we took seven, I think, or eight total and brought them all together to launch Mirum about 2 years ago, which now is over 2,000 people in over 20 plus countries. And so, you know, I feel we did it. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like we started this thing called Twist Image. We had certain aspirations, and it wasn't like we opened a new chapter. I feel like we closed the book on Twist Image and we started a new book called Mirum. You know, the idea of Twist Image was, we're going to build this digital agency. It became very successful. We had multiple offices. We had a lot of great clients. We sold it to the number one player in the business. They then took that business along with sort of our consulting and turned it into Mirum, and Mirum becomes a new book. And so that's why I think it's both exciting and great. And I have a lot of pride for it, but also challenging. You know, it's all these years later and you're building a brand new brand in a very busy and noisy world.
So that's what I was going to ask you, in terms of, here you are, an agency that's nowhere near the size of WPP and you get acquired by them. Was there challenges integrating into their work environment? I know they let you run independently, but there's still,
yeah, WPP
there's still structures.
WPP doesn't really operate. I mean, it's their business, and they want you to run it according to how they operate. They are a public company, and there are all levels of compliance and Sarbanes-Oxley and fun things like that. I can tell you that, yeah, when you integrate financially and operationally, there's always things we did that they don't do or things they do that we don't do. You have to have humility. We're very small. You know, we're 100 plus people. It's a small business for them. They have over 300,000 employees. Yeah. This is a $30+ billion company. It's not, it's not what we're operating here as a two off. So it's humbling to be, you know, I always say, I love going to the JWT office in New York and not a single soul knows who I am. And it's not because I have an ego. It's good. It's good that it's that type of a business where not everyone's like, oh my God, it's the guy from Six Pixels. And I like the fact that no one knows and no one cares. It's great.
So now you kind of brought that up. So, you know, with WPP, was part of the, was there any conversation about 6pixels and the book you released in 2013 and the brand of Mirum together? Was there a conversation about how or what you can and can't do based on that?
Well, the conversation pre-acquisition was more like, here's the five reasons we think we're a good fit for WPP. And let's say this sort of this sort of monetization of thought leadership, like let's call it that 6pixels brand, books, blogs, popularity podcasts, writing, speaking, blah, blah, blah. They maybe moved it from number five to number three in terms of reasons. That they really thought, wow, this is unique in the sense of we've rarely met an agency where they really monetize this stuff really well. I think they were just overly impressed with that as a sort of idea. So that's one part of it. But no, post-acquisition, it's business as usual. We're just running the business. The real challenge is that people call it Mirum, not Mirum. People don't know what Mirum is. It's so much bigger that it's harder. You know, it is somewhat easier to build a brand when it's only two offices in one country. It's really hard for me to demonstrate or emote a platform that is outside of North America. I mean, I have one, but it's small. My listeners on my podcast, my blog, my articles, it is global, but it's not at the same veracity as we have it in the States and in Canada to a certain degree. So it's those challenges, but no, they're not like, so let's sit down and discuss where you're going to speak or what you're going to write about. Yeah. Zero. If anything, it's the reverse. If anything, they're like, how do we tap into how much you're creating? And how do we, like, you can go on the Mirum blog on any day and they have their own blog. It's on the 6pixels one, and they'll like grab content from my blog and put it there. It's just the nature of the beast.
Yeah, they're trying to utilize your strength and the position in the market to better them.
But they don't even use all of it because they've got their own game. It's a big company.
Yeah. Can I just say one thing I really admire, by the way, about you is that there's many things I admire about you, but the fact that how far ahead of the game you were on podcasts.
Like, I'm like, can you compliment me on how big of a glutton of punishment I am? And after all this, I still don't have a popular podcast. One, thank you. I really do appreciate when people acknowledge it because I do look at it as one of the few things in my life and go, like, it is pretty crazy that after all these years, I still do it every single Sunday. And it's, 560 plus of those. So you can do the math on that. I'm also really happy because I feel like the validation of the model, it was right. I was like, there's nowhere to get these really long form, in-depth conversations with people that I want to hear from. You'd be lucky if you get 15 minutes of it on a PBS episode or something. And then seeing people like Mark Maron and Joe Rogan and Brian Koppelman and all these people, come by and literally blast me out of the stratosphere in terms of guests but knowing that they're doing shows that are, 40 minutes to 2 hours even.
Yeah, two hours is a bit long.
Yeah, but it feels very validating to me. It means that, again, how long should a story be? As long as the story is, right? So I feel really validated that, like, wow, I did have a thought back then of, like, radio is radio. How can I use this format to do something you can't do with radio in terms of audio? And that sort of audio experimentation component of it, it's why I love doing my show, and I love doing shows like this. It just it gives me great joy that there's somebody out there who also likes this type of format.
Oh, I just kind of – I mean, research. I just thought to myself, he was so far ahead of the curve.
It was early days. And I'll tell you a funny story about that. I remember some of my best friends in the world now are people that I met at the first PodCamp, which was an unconference for podcasting. And I just started my show back then. I don't even remember what year it was. You'd have to look up like first PodCamp or PodCamp Boston. It was like an event put on by like Christopher S. Penn and Chris Brogan and guys that are now sort of both legendary and people I consider really close friends. And I remember driving there thinking, I'm so late in the game on this podcast. I think it's crazy. Because at that point, there was like Joe Jaffe had Across the Sound and Terry Fallis and I'm pulling a blank. He's going to kill me when he's – the other guys were inside PR. And then there was Shel Holtz and Neville Hobson doing 4Media. Like there was always already this holy trinity. And I was like, David Jones, Dr. Jones, he was the other guy for Inside PR. And I thought, there's already a holy trinity of like communication podcasts. What am I even bothering for? And like, here we sit now years later, like it's almost laughable.
Well, and I think, so I guess two more questions that I'm going to let you run is, like, where do you think podcasts are going? I mean, the market is so flooded now, right? So I'm one of 200,000. I personally think what I do is unique because not many people do what I do from a business perspective. So I don't take pride in many things that I do, but I take pride in this. But where do you think podcasting is going? Because now it's gone from a lot of long form back to short form, and now research is saying it's going back towards long form. Like, where do you think this ends up?
I don't know that there's a sort of answer for it. I think human beings have a thirst for audio content. There's a lot of different models. There's, you know, the people at Podcast One in LA are doing some interesting thing, building networks and channels and platforms. There's radio trying to figure out what face it will hold. There's the integrated platforms like NPR does or CBC in Canada, where they're both extensions and opportunities. Right now, I still think the biggest challenge is that it is still clunky. I think it is still really clunky. It's still other than, it's not an audio thing. It's not, you know, really in iTunes, it's, or Apple Music, whatever they call it now. I don't even know. I still feel it's like this thing off to the side. So for me, what will make it really work is once it becomes way more connected and ubiquitous and easy. It's easy, don't get me wrong, but I think people still like grabbing the podcast app, subscribing, grabbing them. I don't know if it's as obvious as it is to people like you and I, for the average Joe, like, how do I get a podcast? Or what is a podcast even? I think they struggle with that too.
Took me a long time to sort that out. I mean, I once I figured out the benefits of having it, I'm totally addicted. I don't actually listen to anything else. But I will tell you that what's amazing is that living in the Middle East, you know, I can ask my students who listens to a podcast. Not a hand goes up, but then someone will say, "Is it that purple box on my phone?" And that's all they know. They don't get it. So like when you think about the potential growth of podcasts, it's unbelievable how much bigger it can get globally.
Yeah. And again, what I love most about any digital content, and even using the word digital might feel weird, but for me, it's sort of emotes or tax something, is that it's the niche of it. So I've been working on a show now for over 2 years for this site called notreble.com. And it's a podcast called Groove, where I'm trying to build very slowly the largest oral history of electric bass players. And it's just this weird, quirky sort of type of musician that I like. It's a type of music that I like, with weird bands that most people haven't heard of. But that thing that I do, which is basically 6 pixels, like my podcast only with bass players, so like long format conversational, is really important work to me. And I know it is to people who like that type of music or those types of musicians, because they're not getting content like this really anywhere else. But it's so niche, you know. It's not like I could have decided to do like this rock podcast for Rolling Stone maybe, and that would have been an easier way to build an audience and have an audience. But that's not what interests me. It's the quirky niche thing. And so it's tied to like great content too. If you go back to 2003, when I started doing content, I always talk about my triangle of excellence, which was, you know, brands on one point, consumers on the other, and technology on the other, and then the bullseye being marketing. So anything that has to do with how brands connect to consumers through technology or vice versa with a marketing thing is my area. Now, fast forward to today, that's not a unique landscape, but back then it was unique. Nobody was doing that. And over time, what happens is you go from having a unique idea to a unique voice. And I'm hopeful that over the time I've evolved from having what was then a very unique piece of content, because no one was talking about that stuff really, to having a unique voice today. And I think that podcasting is going to go through that same thing, where there's a lot of people with these sort of these unique ideas, unique thoughts, unique formats. And eventually what's going to happen is they're going to start turning into really unique voices. And some people have really transcended that really quickly, like a Marc Maron or Brian Koppelman, while others might toil away in ambiguity and never sort of find that. And maybe new voices will arise too.
Well, and I actually think the evolution of podcast becomes more like series. I mean, not using Serial as the prime example, but I think for many people, there's a middle, beginning, middle, and end. And so if you have a 5-part, 10-part series, you can really grab people's attention throughout that. And so I think that's the evolution of like many shows, like NPR having one show after another that they keep doing. I think that's an evolution to get more people on board in the podcasting hubs, because it's like TV. It's going back to the 1920s when radio was the main form of entertainment. But now it's a flexible form of entertainment you can get wherever you want.
Yeah, I mean, so yes, for me, that's not what excites me. For me, what excites me is more of the fact that if I like magic, I can subscribe to the most amazing close quarters magicians and watch them explain tricks and how they do them in these long, deep interviews. And just having that, to me, is what makes it so good. I don't necessarily know that I need a different format to hear a type of news story that you can see in many other formats, if you know what I mean. So I don't disagree. I think that you're right from a mass perspective. But what makes me excited is that real obscure, long, in-depth world. And again, like, the real value that I'm experiencing now on Facebook is in private groups. And it's people who are really specific about a real specific topic. And everyone's diving in deep because they love it so much. And that's building the community, which circles back to, you know, growing up in Montreal. I just didn't have that. You know, if I liked comic books, it was very, you know, it was very hard to find others like me. Now, if I'm into nonfiction writing, which I am, and I have a private Facebook group for people like that who've done publishing, it's amazing to see 300 or 400 people who are really well established to external people, like in terms of having fan base and audience, but know that we could talk about things like, you know, Amazon changing their bestseller list, and no one rolls their eyes like, how boring. But it's like, really, what happened? Like, it's almost like that's our breaking news. That's what I love so much about that space.
Well, I mean, so we agree with each other on both sides, because I think the niche part will always make it unique as well. So last question, because I could talk to you probably for maybe 3.5 hours, maybe 4. So I don't want to keep you on. How do you, for where you're at in your life and for what you do, how do you define happiness?
You know, happiness for happy. It's a weird thing. I just had this conversation, talk about things I don't talk about publicly, which I'll share with you, with my wife, about how I was somewhere having dinner. And, you know, she was going through what moms go through at that time of the night, homework and bath and crazy. And it wasn't a fight. It was just more like, enjoy your dinner type of thing, you know? And I remember saying back to her something, which is, it makes your question hard to answer, which is, you can't be mad at any of this stuff, because I decided long before I met you or decided to get married or have kids that I would never do anything professional that didn't give me joy. And so it's, you know, like, yeah, to the outside person following me on Facebook or Instagram or Twitter, it's like, look at the life he leads. And I'm not sitting there going, yeah, that's right. Look at the life I lead. I'm sitting there going, I planned that from when I was really young. I said, I always want to wear jeans and I don't want to wear a suit, and I wanted to have fun and I want to enjoy what I do. And that is, for most people, it's really hard. Really hard. I'll call it, well, you're a workaholic, you're this. It's really hard for them to understand that there is no reason why you can't design that life too. It might be harder now, for sure it would be for me. But I literally didn't do it for money. I did it because I thought it was fun. So when people say to me, what do you, you know, what makes you happy? I sort of go, sort of, this makes me happy, you know, mm-hmm. Sort of like the fact that that part worked out.
Well, I always think that cliche of do what makes you happy will make you money down the road. Right. So,
yeah. And I don't know. I mean, I know a lot of people who try that and don't. So, you know, I prefer the old cliche. I got lucky.
Yeah. You hear that a lot too. So, well, listen, Mitch, I really enjoyed your time, energy, and willing to sit down with me on Executive After Hours. It was a pleasure. And, your persistence in rescheduling with me and my persistence of emailing you. Hopefully you enjoyed your time.
That was great. I appreciate the time. Thank you so much, James.